Welcome to Oak City Church, a family of learners, lovers, and givers sent. For more information, visit us online at oakcitychurch.com. Let us know if we can help you in any way. Thank you for listening.
Well, good morning. Welcome to Oak City Church. My name is Jeff, and we're really glad that you're here this morning and joining us for the beginning of a series that we're doing with, it's like 50 other churches around the Triangle that are doing this series at the same time called Explore God. The question that we're starting with, as you can see from the video, is there a God? I was showing the little card about the series to a friend of mine. He was looking through the questions and saw the first one. He said, "Man, you're coming in hot, aren't you?" And I was like, "Am I?" And he's like, "Oh yeah, you are." And I was like, "Okay." And so we're in church, and so I don't want to give the whole thing away, but I'm going to come up with the answer that you think I would, that I do believe that God exists, and I'm going to give you some reasons for that. But I think all of these questions are just not easy questions, and they're questions that are common questions about faith in general and the Christian faith in particular, and I think they're meaningful responses to them, and I think there's a sure basis on which to place your faith, not only that God exists, but in who Christ is and what he's done for you, and we hope to offer that to you in a respectful manner over the next couple of weeks. I think about this stuff a lot. When we decided to do this series, I got excited because I'm kind of naturally curious, and these are questions that I've been asking for a long time. I would say that faith doesn't come easy for me, which may be surprising for a pastor to say that faith doesn't come easy for me, but I think that's kind of the way that it is. And over the years in the Bible, I've recognized more and more characters for whom faith doesn't come easy, probably most of them, you know, and so I think God gets that if you're in that category of faith doesn't come easy for you, and we live in a culture that makes that tough. And so I found this quote a few years ago from a pastor in New York. He said, "We used to live in a culture of belief that was tempted to doubt. Now we live in a culture of doubt that's tempted to believe." And I think that's true in a lot of ways. And I think it's helpful to recognize that that's kind of the air we breathe right now. And to keep that in mind as we're thinking through these things. I've also said to our church a handful of times that we live in a culture, we are a people that says, I'll believe it when I see it, you know, prove it. But God is a God who frequently says, you'll see it after you believe it. And there's a trust element. We can't prove this stuff. There's a trust element to me. And that, at times, has been really frustrating. But the longer I walk with Jesus, the more I think that makes sense. Like, A, that the natural is not going to be able to prove or really grasp the supernatural. And also, that if God wants to have a relationship with you, all relationships are based on trust. And so there's going to be an element of trust in this as well. I watched the video, and I'm just reminded that everybody believes something. And I think that all the time. Everybody believes something, and their beliefs are, you know, based on experiences and research and conversations, and all of those opinions should be treated with great respect. And we don't get to the level of talking through those things often enough, like these deep, meaningful issues of life. And so I hope today and the next several weeks will give you the opportunity to have conversations that you don't normally have with folks, whether it be the person you're sitting next to here this morning, or we have home groups that meet throughout the week that are going to be discussing these questions, or they said there's 50 churches, so if you go to triangleexploregod.com, there are discussion groups meeting throughout the area where people are going to be talking through these issues. And if you're here, you're at least in part of you, like, you want to engage these questions. And so my goal this morning is to give you some evidence on which you can base your faith that God does exist. And I think there's great evidence to do that. People sometimes talk about, or they think about, faith as like a blind leap. And I don't think that's the case. I think there's evidence, and you choose to put your faith in evidence, and it's not proof, but it is evidence. And I actually think there's evidence for the existence of God it's really hard to deny, that you really have to do something with if you're going to choose to believe that God doesn't exist. So I'm going to start by, the way that I'm going to go through this morning is give three pieces of evidence I think are really good evidence to believe that God exists. And then I'm going to go through quickly three reasons why I think people struggle to believe or to act on their belief in our day and age. And I have a few caveats before I start. One is that this format and this question particularly lends itself a little bit more to lecture than to sermon, but I'm going to break out in a sermon right at the end, okay? So just know that's coming. The next one is that we have a little bit of time, and so I can scratch the surface on, you know, questions that people have been asking forever. And I'm going to move through some of this stuff fairly fast, and part of that is just to let you know there's a lot out there. There's a lot of great evidence, and people have thought about this a lot. And if you want to talk more with me about it, I'd love to do that sometime over coffee or lunch or a beer or whatever. And so I'm wide open for that if you want to talk more about it. And the third caveat is that I am not that smart. And so I read and I listen to people that are a bunch smarter than me. And if this, in college, we had like 100 level courses and 200 level courses and 300 and 400. This is not a graduate seminar. This is like a 100-200 level course this morning that we're going to go through. And there's a lot more out there that a lot smarter people can give to you. So, all right. Here are these, let me list these and then I'll go through them, these three pieces of evidence that God exists. One is the existence of morality. The second is the design evident in the natural world. And then finally, the occurrences of the supernatural that we experience. And so the existence of morality. I grew up going to church, and I grew up going to a church that I think taught me to be good. And now churches should teach you that. But that shouldn't be all of what they teach you. And when I was in middle school, my parents split up. We stopped going to church. A few years later, my dad started going to a different church that I think taught like the broader message of the Bible, the gospel, which is that God has done something for you in Christ that you could not do for God. That this is not about what you do for him, but what he has done for you. And we take that to be the message of the gospel, what Jesus has done for us on the cross. And I thought, oh, that makes a ton of sense. And so I gave my life to Jesus and started following him through high school. And then I got to college. And this is not uncommon, but people get kind of a hiccup in college. And so I went to a sociology class. And my sociology professor said, you only believe what you believe because you're socialized to believe it. And I thought, oh, he's right. And later I thought, what else is a sociology professor going to tell you than that, you know? But at the time I thought, oh, is it true? And he went to church. So he's a church-going guy. And we're all like, what are we supposed to do? And but it connected with something in me that just wondered that. Like, is this really my faith or is it my father's faith or what do I do about that? And I had the questions, really the questions that we're going to go through over the next few weeks. And at the same time, there were a few things that I wanted to do. This was college that my faith was precluding me from doing. And so really what I did in hindsight is I ignored the questions and didn't really address the questions. And I regret that in hindsight, but that's what I did at the time. And I got a few years out of college, and my life was in order. Like, on the outside, things looked really good, but on the inside, things were a mess, and I knew it, and I had no peace, and I knew that those questions needed to be resolved in my relationship with God and some resolution there. So I went to him and just said, okay, I'm going to pursue you, not just intellectually, like with my actions as well, but I need some resolution to this. Now, at the time, this book, Mere Christianity, by a guy named C.S. Lewis, ended up being, like, God used this in a big way. Lewis was a British intellectual. He was an atheist into his 30s. He taught, he was a literature professor of renown at Oxford and Cambridge, and he described himself as the most reluctant convert in all of England when he eventually came to faith. And the first part of it is why he believes in God, just God, and the second part of it is what he believes about the Christian faith, mere Christianity, the basics of it, which are really deep. But he starts with the issue of morality, and this is what led him to believe in God. The fact that we think that there's a right and wrong has to have a basis in something, and it's so strong in us. And so we ought not have an ought to if there isn't a God to give it to us. And so he uses some examples about people keeping their promises and people not cutting in line. And I started to think through, what are the things that, like, just get us most frequently and most deeply where we know there's right and wrong? And one of the first things I thought of was road rage. Right? How many of you experienced road rage in the last week? How many of you experienced road rage on the way to church this morning? You know, because I can't drive for more than like 10 minutes without getting really angry at you about the way that you drive. Because you need to stop looking at your phone when you're driving the bullet that is your car, you know? Like, we just not ought to do that. And I ought to stop looking at my phone. And I don't get any madder at anybody than myself when I realize what I'm doing. And being at a stoplight and the light turns green and nobody goes and you know what they're doing, like, I'm so quick on my horn. I'm convinced there are stoplight cycles where people have just, on all four sides, just sat through like a whole cycle of it because everybody's looking at their phone. And I legit fear this, is that I'm going to like pull up next to somebody because I'm so angry and I'm just going to give them the business just like, bah, 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 you know, no gestures because we're talking about right and wrong and I know gestures are wrong, but I'm just going to like be really angry with somebody and then I'm going to realize that they go to church here. Or worse, that they're going to show up Sunday as a visitor and they're going to like make eye contact with me and they're just going to walk right out like, I know who you are. But we have a deep-seated sense of right and wrong. I was thinking about lines. He talked about when someone cuts you in lines. And when you think about lines, where do you think of? What place do you think of about waiting? The DMV! This is two for two on services that thought about the DMV. The DMV, you walk into the DMV, you know there's right and wrong in the universe, and this is wrong. Like, apologies if you work at the DMV, but you know it's wrong too. And so if you're waiting in the DMV for 45 minutes, and somebody tries to cut in line on you, like, it's on. You know what I mean? Like, it's going to come to fisticuffs there, because there's just something wrong with that. I think about our, like, you scroll through the menu on your TV, whatever it is, and half of them are crime shows because we want the bad guy to get it. Like, we want justice in the world. I think about the news. I think what's going on in Syria and that this guy gassed his own people, and you think this is just wrong. You think about the shootings, and you think it's just wrong. Like, so much of it is tied up in that people's personal stories. Like, if you get cheated on, you know that's wrong. And so we have this deep-seated sense of justice, and Lewis goes down into this, and why do we have an ought to? Like, if God doesn't exist, then we shouldn't have an ought to. There's no basis for morality. Morality is, at best, in that situation, relative. And morality is determined by the crowd, by the power. And, in the 20th century, we saw a few instances in Germany and Russia where millions of people died because morality was determined by the crowd, you know? And he goes through this and says, well, then we instantly compare. They say, well, their morality wasn't very good. Our morality is better than their morality. But he says, in doing that, you're appealing to a higher standard of morality, and you're just saying mine adheres better to it than theirs did. And he says, where did that come from? And he makes a great argument for this. When you go down into that, and some people argue that's like a herd instinct. And so I think Richard Dawkins would say this, that our selflessness comes from our selfishness, and we realize the best thing we can do for ourselves is be selfless. I just don't think, I've read it, I don't think it holds water. People have a really hard time doing this. Where human rights come from, and we're struggling more and more with this, where does that come from? There was a scientist from the Russian Academy of Scientists that said, we thought we could abolish God and retain a value for human beings. We couldn't, and we murdered 60 million people in the process. And so, like I said, I can only get started down this road, but I have yet to hear a good explanation of why we have such a deeply embedded sense of justice, other than that there is a standard of justice out there, and it's defined by the essence of God, and we're drawn to it. And the Bible would speak to this by saying we're made in the image of God. And so God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And so we have that implicit sense of right and wrong because we're made in the image of God. Now, the second thing I would turn to is the design evident in the natural world. So there is a TV show on the National Geographic channel right now called One Strange Rock. Has anybody watched this? You guys need to watch more TV. It's on Monday nights at like 10 o'clock, and it's one of those Earth shows about how amazing the Earth is. This one's cooler because it's got astronauts in it, and so they interview a bunch of astronauts that have spent a bunch of time in space, and these guys are scientists, you know? And they're just talking about how amazing it is and how interconnected everything on the Earth is and how it all works together. And one of the guys starts talking about how thin the atmosphere is and how the gravitational force of the Earth is the perfect size to hold it just in place. And it reminded me of a book I picked up a few years ago, and I've read it a handful of times since then, called Miracles. And he deals with the supernatural in the book, but the first third of the book is just science. It's just like stuff that is, but statistically it's miraculous that it is the way that it is. And so he goes through this stuff about the size of the earth and how if the earth were just a shade bigger than it is, the gravitational force would be such that it would pull methane and ammonia down to the surface, and we wouldn't be able to breathe, and we'd all die, and we couldn't have this conversation. But if it was a shade smaller than it is, then the oxygen wouldn't be held down towards the surface of the earth, and we'd have nothing to breathe, and we'd all die, and we wouldn't be having this conversation. If the earth spun, rotated just a little bit faster than it does, then the wind would be such that nothing could survive on it, and so we'd all die and wouldn't be having this conversation. But if it rotated just a little bit slower, it would get so hot during the day and so cold during the night that nothing could survive, and we would all die, and we wouldn't be having this conversation. And he goes on through this about how the distance of the earth to the sun and the moon and how the moon was formed, like the going theory on that is crazy, and how it's perfectly positioned to help life survive on Earth, and the four fundamental first forces of the universe that were formed in the first milliseconds after the Big Bang, and they are like just within fractions of percentage points. If they're just off by a fraction of a percentage point, like life as we know it just doesn't exist anywhere in the universe. And the astronaut, they asked him, do you think there's life on other planets? And he says, you know, I've spent a lot of time out there, and there's so many stars and so many planets, and so I think that there is, but we have no evidence. I have no evidence on which to base that belief, but I believe it. And in that, he talks about just how miraculous it is that the Earth is the way that the Earth is. That complexity and design, that creates a difficulty for certain scientists. And so there was a quote from it's a guy named Robert Jastrow. He was the founder of the Goddard Institute of Space Studies at NASA and taught geophysics at Columbia. And he speaks into this about the complexity and about even just the Big Bang and how that threw things into a little bit of a muddle for people. He said, I think part of the answer is that scientists can't bear the thought of a natural phenomenon which cannot be explained even with unlimited time and money. There's a kind of religion in science, the religion of a person who believes there's order and harmony in the universe. Every event can be explained in a rational way as the product of some previous event. Every effect must have its cause, but there's no first cause. This religious faith of the scientist is violated by the discovery that the world had a beginning under conditions in which the known laws of physics aren't valid, and as a product of forces or circumstances we can't discover. When that happens, the scientist has lost control. If he really examined the implications, he would be traumatized. I want to be really careful because science is awesome. You can read back through the history of science, and I think God gave us science. Like Christian faith led to the development of modern science in Europe. And I think I would have been good at it because I think that way. I think I would have enjoyed that enterprise. But like there are limits to it. And I think sometimes science and scientists and we have problems admitting the limits to it. And I don't think it has to be that way, but in certain circles it is. I found this quote from Einstein, and he said, I'm not an atheist. The problem involved is too vast for our limited minds. We're in the position of a little child entering a huge library filled with books in many languages. The child knows someone must have written those books. It doesn't know how. It doesn't understand the languages in which they're written. The child dimly suspects a mysterious order in the arrangement of the books, but doesn't know what it is. That, it seems to me, is the attitude of even the most intelligent human being toward God. We see the universe marvelously arranged and obeying certain laws, but only dimly understand these laws. And I think that's these complexities and design are meant, like God meant for them to point us to him. And you start seeing them all the time. Like I cut my hand this week and it got better. I think that's miraculous. Like, if that wasn't the case, we'd all have 700 Band-Aids on our bodies that we'd be constantly changing, you know? Our skin is waterproof. Think for just a second how much of a pain it would be if that was not the case, you know? I read years ago about a muscle in your heart that contracts once. It fires once and then it atrophies, and it's at birth, and it closes a flap between your ventricles so that your body can start oxygenating its own blood, and you don't have to depend on your mom to do that for you anymore. And it just fires once, and then it goes away. And I just think that's crazy. I have a friend who went to the Apple store a few years ago and was talking to the guy at the Genius Bar and just got in a conversation about faith and asked him if he believed in God. He said, yeah, and she said, why? And he said, the trees breathe out what I breathe in, and I breathe out what the trees breathe in. Like, and he said, I don't think that just happened. And I get that. I think it's a logical place to go to point to a creator. There was another book, and I read this a few years ago, by a guy who was the leading atheistic philosopher of the 20th century. His name is Anthony Flew. And he was the guy that the new atheists, the current guys, kind of based their work on. But he wasn't angry. The new atheists seemed really angry, and he wasn't angry. And at the end of his life, he became a theist. So he kind of went back on his life's work and became a theist. And what did it for him was the multiverse. So the multiverse is the theory that there are an infinite number of parallel universes to our own universe, and there's scant, at best, evidence for the multiverse, but he felt like it was postulated to deal with the design in our universe, that there are a bunch of other universes that don't have that design, and so that is the way that we work out the statistics. And the guy said, it's more logical to postulate the existence of a supernatural God than it is to do this. And that's just where it drove him. He wasn't angry, it wasn't emotional, it's just logical where it went to for him. And I think that's how God meant for it to be. So Psalm 19 says, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. It's designed to point us in the direction of God. In Romans, Paul writes, God's invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. And so we perceived it, and it points us to him. And he includes a warning with that. He says, so they're without excuse, for although they knew God, they didn't honor him as God or give thanks to him, but became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. And so he says that there's an equation, and God has to be a part of it. And when you take him out, you're going to end up at a point of futility without him in the equation. And so I think that is the design evident in nature is part of that. Now, the occurrence, this got tagged into this point, but the occurrence of the supernatural is the third thing I would point to, among many other things. So I had an experience. I was driving home from college. I went to college outside Cincinnati, and I lived in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And so this is your geography test for the day. What state did I have to drive through to get from Cincinnati to Milwaukee? Remember, Wisconsin and Wyoming are two different places. You know, it's not as far as that. What do I have to drive through? Indiana. Good. How many people have ever driven through Indiana? Yeah, it was an unforgettable experience for you, wasn't it? It was just a tough place. I drove through there a million times. It's just flat, and there's anything, and so it's hard. And it was 11:30 at night, and my roommate was asleep next to me, and so I thought I could keep driving, you know, but you've never been there, and you're like dozing off, but I think I can, you know? And so I started drifting off the left side of the road. I'm into the shoulder, and my roommate punches me in the arm, punches me good in the arm, and so I wake up, and I realize I'm almost off the shoulder, and I'm like, you know, and then I'm too far that way, and then I'm like this, and this, and this, and this, and then I end up like this, you know, just on the side of the road, and my roommate's like, what just happened? And I said, well, I was going off the left side of the road, and you punched me in the arm, and he said, I didn't punch you in the arm. I said, yeah, you punched me in the arm. He said, I didn't punch you in the arm. I was asleep. And so I don't know what happened there. I know my roommate punched me in the arm, and I know my roommate was asleep right before he punched me in the arm. How many of you have had something happen in your life that you just have no explanation for? Like, it just, you put it away someplace, but you just don't have a good explanation for it. I find that most people have that. Like, they don't know what to do with it, and I didn't, in that moment, repent of all my sins and give my life completely to Jesus. You know, I drove to Wisconsin. But I know something happened there, and I don't know what to do with it. And I think that type of thing happens all the time. This book, the second two-thirds of the book, is, and this guy went to Yale. He works in New York City. He writes biographies of famous, big, long biographies of famous dead people. He's an intellectual. He asked his friends that he knows like well enough to vouch for their character, has anything miraculous ever happened to you? And he writes their stories down in the second two-thirds of the book, and they are crazy stories and undeniable stories. And I think, like most people, have an experience like that. If you Google near-death experiences, give yourself a couple hours to deal with what you find there. But somehow, that doesn't quite sway us. But I think it should. So there's an article by a guy named Ross Douthat in the New York Times, and so I'm going to read a paragraph or two from it. And keep in mind that he's in New York, and everybody in New York thinks they're smarter than you and I, so they use really big words. And so that's going to be part of this quote. So he says this. He says, the key feature of a secular world picture, and a secular world picture would be one that excludes God from it, isn't that it requires people to reinterpret their numerous experiences as strictly psychological events. It's simply that it discourages people who have such experiences from embracing any kind of systematic interpretation of what's happened. So don't put it in some religious theological system. It's just a one-off event. He says, and then as a corollary, discourages them from seeking out a permanent communal space, a religious body, in which to further interact with these ultimate realities. Under secularism, in other words, most people who see a ghost or have a vision or otherwise step into the supernatural are still likely to believe in the essential reality of their encounter with the otherworldly or transcendent. They're just trained to isolate the experience, to embrace it as an interesting and often hopeful mystery without letting it call them into the larger conversion of life that most religious traditions claim that the capital S supernatural asks of us in return. And so he says, as a culture, we're trained to kind of put that experience off in a corner and not deny it, but don't think too much about it because and not respond to it because there's nothing you can do with it. You know, you can't make it happen again, which honestly drives us a little bit crazy. And so don't worry about it. And I think he's right. I think that's what culture trains us to do with our own experiences and the experience of those close to us with things that don't fit. The writer of a book in the Bible called Ecclesiastes says that God has made everything beautiful in its time, and also he's put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. And so he's put eternity into our hearts. We know there's something more than this, but we're not going to be able to spell it all out and figure it all out. I think about the astronaut and them asking him if he believes that there's something out there and him saying yes, and it made me think about how it seems like every other week there's an article about how we found more planets, astronomers have found more planets, and they're the size of Earth, and their sun is the size of our sun, and so there's life out there someplace. Like, and it seems like we're desperate to find life beyond us. And I think these people have never watched the movies because that doesn't go well for us. You know, they should watch Independence Day like 10 times and then just shut the whole project down because if there's life out there, we don't want to find it. But I think we're desperate because we know there's something more. I just don't think it lies necessarily where they're looking. So these three things, the morality within us, the design within us and outside of us, and the occurrence of the supernatural, I think are good, you know, places to start. And I think as you press into those things, you're going to have to, you're really going to have to deal with them. You know, like we see a law outside of us, we see a law inside of us, and I think that points to a lawgiver, and that's a logical thing to do. Now, why don't people believe? Or why do people struggle to believe enough that it moves them to action? And let me just throw out a few things pretty quickly. One is this, that people have had bad experiences that steer us away from faith. And so this is you know, common and legitimate. Next week, we're going to deal with the question of pain and suffering. Why would a good God allow pain and suffering? Which is a great question. It's a hard question. So Greg's going to preach on it, not me. But that's what we're going to deal with next week. And the Bible speaks to that. You know, the book of Job, people think, is the oldest written book in the Bible. And that's the Bible that's the most relevant to it. And we still pull that out because it's still completely relevant to it. God knows and God speaks to it. And the cross speaks deeply to it. But it's hard. And I get it. Along with that, and as a pastor, I'm probably sensitive to this, people have had bad experiences with people that represent God, either claim to represent God or do. And so I know as a pastor, like, I'm not a great representation of what God is like. And so if that's what people are taking it from, then that's problematic. You know, there's one person that represented God super well, and that was Jesus, and the rest of us have screwed it up. So apologies for that. But that's a reason why people struggle, I think. Another one is what I've been alluding to, is that we live in a culture of doubt when it comes to matters of faith. And so there's something culturally that presses us to not engage faith. There was a movie a few years ago, The Martian. Y'all see The Martian? Anybody? So Matt Damon, that bunch of folks go to Mars, and Matt Damon gets stuck there. I forget what happens, but he gets stuck on Mars. They think he's dead, and they go back to Earth. They're like halfway there, and they realize Matt Damon's alive. And he's like, hey, guys. And they're like, whoops. Like, our bad, man. But we're already halfway to Earth. And so that's the tension in the movie. But he, stuck on Mars, is like, no problem. I can figure this out until you guys get here. And there's a line. Does anybody know what line I'm going after here? Does anybody remember the movie well? Because there's a line, and he says a word that I can't say in church. So he says, I'm going to science the you-know-what out of this. Like, you saw it, right? And so I risk saying, like, alluding to a word that might offend somebody because I think the line is so emblematic for where our culture is. We think we can use science to explain absolutely everything. And we can use science to explain lots of things, but not everything. And so that line, I think, is where our culture is. And I think there are, like, people talk about God and the gaps, and so there are gaps in our understanding, and we just put God there. And I think sometimes we do oversimplify things. But I think at the same time, I think people put science in the gaps and think that science is going to explain everything, which honestly I think is a little, at the end of the day, it's a little arrogant. Like, I think science can fill plenty of gaps, but there are gaps that it can't fill. And I think that's because I think science has a hard time explaining increasing evidence for complexity at really fundamental levels. And in part because science can answer how questions really well, but it can't answer why questions. And a lot of times it steps into that, into the why questions. And I think we'll always live in that tension. But God ends up being seen in our culture as like a simplistic cop-out explanation, and I just don't think that's true. One philosopher suggested that the way that we tend to look at this right now is that it's like a drunk guy lost his keys at night, and he insisted that the only place his keys could be are underneath the streetlight because that's the only place he could see, and so his keys must be there. And that's what we tend to do with science when there are other things out there that may be beyond our explanation. And I get that science has to work on the premise that we can explain everything to pursue, and I don't know how you resolve that tension, but that tension's there. I don't think science is going to be able to explain, like, the most fundamental thing that everybody gets is that we're made to love and to be loved. Like, underneath it, we know that. And I don't think science is going to figure that out. We know there's good and evil outside of us and inside of us. And I don't think science is going to have a great answer for that. I don't think science is going to be able to figure out beauty. I don't think science is going to figure out meaning, you know? Thinkers like Nietzsche and Huxley took this to its end and said, yeah, if there's no God, then none of that stuff really exists, and ended up, you know, going way to another side of this thing. But I think they were honest in the conclusions that you have to get to if you take God out of the picture. And I think it's okay for us not to be able to understand all of it. If God created 2 trillion galaxies and our brain is the size of a Big Mac, and I say this from time to time, we're not going to be able to figure him out completely, and that's all right. And I'll get to this last reason I think that people struggle with belief, and I think, and this one, if this is you, you got to be real careful, is that people don't want to deal with the implications of belief. So they don't really engage it. And so those 5 years of my life in college and post-college, I didn't want answers. I preferred questions. Answers had implications. Answers lead to actions. And I just wanted questions at that time in my life. And I think people can get stuck in that spot and not even know it. One guy was talking about how doubt in our culture is kind of a heroic story right now. So I'm going to read this, and if this is you, like, I just ask you to be careful. He said, conversion to atheism or conversion to exclusive humanism is motivated often by a particular moral narrative. It isn't simply a matter of being faced with the science, following a syllogism to its logical conclusion, and deciding God doesn't add up. Instead, deconversion is more of a decision to follow a particular story about belief and doubt. In this story, doubt is the movement of a heroic individual stepping into intellectual adulthood and maturity, no matter what the cost. Moving to an exclusive humanism away from their earlier childish faith requires virtues such as disengaged reason, the courage to let go of comforting illusions, and the reliance on one's own reason against authority. Though not easy, doubt is brave and it's strong and it's daring. And I know I got caught up in those narratives. Like when I read that, I get that. And I know I have conversations with people that are in those. Like I was talking with someone just a few weeks ago, talking about their doubts. And I asked, well, who's speaking into that? And the only people he could name are skeptics. And I said, well, are you talking to, you know, are you listening to anybody that's like sure of why they think the Bible is the Word of God? And he isn't. Like he's just looking at one side because all he wants to hear is one side. And be careful that that's not you, because you can stay here for as long as you want to. But if God is, and if God is personal, and God wants to relate to you, and I believe all those things are true, then that really matters. And you need to do what you can to get your questions answered and to figure that out. The best reason, I think, to believe in God is Jesus. And so the author of Hebrews says this, long ago at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, he's spoken to us by his son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom he also created the world. And Jesus is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. And Jesus upholds the universe by the word of his power. And so in Jesus, like he gives us this picture of exactly what he's like. And we know there's something different about the life of Jesus. Even the things that I've talked about, like the existence of a morality within us, Jesus resolves that. Like, we know that morality within us, and we know we've done things we ought not do and thinks things that we ought not think, and we can't control it. And Jesus provides an answer with what he's done for us on the cross and with his own life of righteousness. And we think about design, and Jesus did these miracles, and he didn't do tricks to show off. He did things that restored creation to the order that it was meant for, to the design that it was meant for. And Jesus, you know, speaks into the supernatural because he was worthy of their worship and worthy of our worship. And God, you just think about this, God came down as Christ because he didn't want us to have a lot of doubts that he is and that he cares for us and what he's like. And so he came. And ultimately, the resurrection of Jesus provides, I mean, Paul said this, if Christ hasn't risen from the dead, our preaching's in vain, and so is your faith. Like, it hinges on this. In a few weeks, I'm going to get into the resurrection and why we believe that and why that's so powerful. God doesn't want knowing him to be a philosophical or intellectual exercise. It's a personal exercise. And if God is so much more than we are, then it makes sense that God is not something we would discover, but someone who would reveal himself to us. And I think that's what happened. There's a verse that was meaningful in my life during that time and since then. But Jesus at one point says to the Jews who'd believed him, if you abide in my word, you're really my disciples, and you'll know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And so he said, in essence, this is, it's not just intellectual. Like, it involves your will. It involves trusting him at some level, and he'll call you to trust him at some level if he's pursuing you right now and you're pursuing him and you're asking these questions. It's not just going to be thinking your way through it. It involves steps of action that you'll know what they are when you know what they are and when he calls you to them. And there's plenty of places in the Bible that say, if you seek him with all of your heart, you're going to find him. But it'll be more than just an intellectual search. He wants you to trust him. I think there's lots of people here that would say he's worthy of your trust. And so if that's the road you're on, if there's any way that we can help you, that's what we're here for. Father, I'm thankful for all of this. I'm thankful for people that you've made smarter than me that have thought through this at deeper levels, and philosophers and professors of literature and scientists, Lord, that you have pointed to yourself and that you've given us abundant evidence to place our faith in, that you are and that you're good and that you love us, and that you want that to be more than intellectual, that you really do want a relationship with us. And so I pray for those who are here today that are here every week, and I pray that they would walk away with confidence in what they believe and why they believe it, and just a sureness that you are and that you love us. And I pray for anyone that's here this morning that's just struggling through all this stuff and they're searching for you, God, that you would speak to them through all this in ways that I can't and that we can't, God, and that they would find you in the midst of that. We love you and pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.